Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Is cooking an art or a science? If there is a secret to making meals that turn out right every time, it might be as simple as experimenting with every possible variable to determine the ideal equipment, ingredients, and cooking techniques for any given recipe. But you don't have to do it yourself, because my guest this hour has built a media empire devoted to conducting that research and sharing the results so that the rest of us can understand not only what works, but why. Christopher Kimball is founder of Cooks Illustrated and Cooks Country magazines and host of America's Test Kitchen on PBS. He'll be in town for an America's Test Kitchen live event on Wednesday, October 29th at the Majestic Theater in Dallas. Chris, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me.
So you today are in the studios of WGBH Boston. I am here in North Texas. Since we're sitting in different studios, I have to ask you whether you are by any chance wearing a costume. And if you're not, I would encourage you to tell me a lie.
I'm dressed like the fairy godmother. How about that? Does that make you feel good?
It makes me feel good.
About me? That's good.
How did the costume thing become an element of the show?
I just discovered this in May. We were filming our 15th season of the show, and my director, Herb Sevish, has been the director since the beginning. I said, Herb, you know, every year I wear crazier and crazier costumes and more of them. Why are we doing this? And he said, oh, I'd just like to embarrass you. So it was his sort of in-joke to get me to dress up like a pumpkin or a piece of fennel or something. So I just think he gets bored, you know. And the other thing is, seriously, I think so many cooking shows, you know, say it's easy to do this, it's easy to do that, it's going to turn out perfectly. We always like to start out with the real world, you know, bad food, things that don't work. And the costume is sort of part of starting off at a common level so the viewer is comfortable. And then we can go on and get more serious about the cooking. But we want to invite people into the kitchen. And, you know, if I'm dressed like Mr. Peanut, you know, maybe that helps. I don't know.
One thing I like about your approach to helping us all cook well is that, you know, if cooking is, if we think of it as an art, then it means some of us just don't have what it takes to do it well. But if it's about following directions, understanding the chemical processes, then, you know, that we can learn.
You know, I've learned over the years that cooking is, or successful cooking at home, is mostly about self-confidence. And that's fear of making a mistake or failing is the biggest reason people either don't try to cook or don't cook as much as they should. And if you say to somebody, look, you know, it wasn't your fault, it was the recipe's fault, which is true most of the time, that gives people the confidence to go in and cook. And you're right. You know, at the highest levels of restaurant cooking, you know, Joel Robuchon or someone like that, or Alain Ducasse, there is art. But at home, you know, your grandmother was a good cook or grandfather because they had 50 or 75 recipes that was their repertoire, and they cooked each recipe 500 times. And so it was second nature, but it was repetition, it was experience, and that's what cooking really is. It's repetition and experience.
And you're basically just speeding up that repetition over time in the same way that, you know, I can have variations of my lentil soup over the course of a year. You just have your staff taking care of this, I don't know, over a matter of days until you get it right.
Yeah, you have to separate two things out. One is personal taste. So, for example, my palate is quote unquote sensitive, so I can't stand a really hot, you know, chilies. Mm-hmm. Other people may love them. I don't want too much cinnamon in my apple pie. You may love cinnamon. Putting that aside, the completely subjective, there is the objective, which is, you know, if your eggs are cold out of the refrigerator, which recipes will work with that and which won't? Well, yellow cakes won't be bothered, but an angel food cake would be. What oven temperature is the best for a particular cut of meat? For example, a shoulder, which is full of collagen and connective tissue, you want a low oven temperature and a long cooking time. There are thousands of things about cooking that are demonstrably objective and scientific. If you cook alcohol in a sauce, no matter how long you cook it, it will always remain 10% alcohol, and that's just a scientific fact. So you can actually get to the root answers to those questions. Then you can pair it with some more subjective decisions and come up with a recipe that you really like.
In your experience, do scientists, in fact, tend to be good cooks?
I don't know enough scientists from their cooking.
Mm-hmm.
Probably it's there is no answer to that. I think all that matters is that you love to cook. And I divide people into two groups, people who love to cook and people who just want to eat. And if you really like the cooking, you know, you don't always want to make the dish in 15 minutes. You think it's time well spent. Those are the people who will be good cooks because they really enjoy it. I mean, a Saturday afternoon for me, if I'm not doing something else, I often like to spend cooking because I would actually prefer to do that than anything else. And those are the people who are the good cooks because they really love the process itself. You know, I always say our show or magazine isn't about the dining room. It's really about the kitchen because that's where we'd rather be.
You guys also test taste some prepared foods and ingredients that we can buy at the store. Can you tell us a little bit about what the process is? First, for your staff who are choking down, I guess, like 15 spoonfuls of mayonnaise before you come in at the end and pick right. the top four, you know, choose one out of the top four. But how does that work?
We've developed this over a long period of time. We'll taste at least 20 people, usually 25 people, sit around this really big oval table, oak table. We have up to 9 things to taste at a time, hopefully a few less than that. We'll take one of the ingredients and put it in twice. So if you're doing dark chocolates, we might have Scharfenberger, for example, or Ghirardelli is number 2 and number 7, and nobody knows that, but we do double up because the results should be identical for both of them in both slots. We'll vary the order of the things being tasted from one taster to another, because you get palate fatigue. So the 8th or 9th ingredient tends to get a worse rating than the number 1 ingredient because you're tired of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's all done without no talking. You obviously, it's a blind taste test. You don't know what you're tasting. And then the results are put through a computer program. We come up with the results. And we're always checking for anomalies to see if there was consistency in what we had. I will say that almost all the time, we come up with very consistent results, and which belays the sort of the question, you know, is it all subjective? If you taste 10 peanut butters or 10 white wine vinegars or 10 dark chocolates, you will get a consensus of opinion really every time.
How do you test palates of prospective employees, and how far down does that go? Is it only the people who are actually cooking that you would want to know about their palate?
No, we'll take people from other departments who want to come to the tasting. You know, it's sort of like the movie MASH, you know, over the loudspeaker system.
Attention, all personnel.
Office. Attention, vinegar being tasted at 10 o'clock. I really object to expert tastings because if you've spent your whole life tasting olive oil or chocolates, and as a matter of fact, years ago, because I'm just, you know, a difficult person, we did a tasting of chocolate with a bunch of experts out in California. And we threw in bakers, and they all picked bakers. Like, bakers came out number 1. So I'm just going like, okay. It's like wine tastings. I've done lots of wine tastings. And you get 2 experts in the room who violently disagree.
Yeah.
Someone says it's swill, and someone says it's a $50 bottle. So I don't want just experts. I want everyday people, because one's food preferences are established early on. You know, there have been cases I know in the office where someone has picked Mrs. Butterworth over real, you know, maple syrup. And that's because she grew up with Mrs. Butterworth. So that's important. You know, you want people with everyday palates, real world palates, because our readers or viewers have not spent their whole life tasting olive oil.
Let's go to the phones now. We have lots of people who have been waiting to ask you their questions. First on the line, we have Kay in Dallas. Hi, Kay.
Hi. I really enjoy both America's Test Kitchen and the all of the Cook's Country magazines and books. So this has been a phone call I've been waiting for a very long time. when a recipe calls for a medium tomato or a large onion, what does that really mean? A large tomato or a large onion here in Texas could be a very, very different thing or a very different size than one in another region that has maybe less produce. And is there a standard weight to keep in mind beyond personal taste? And then adjacent to that, is there a way to reliably convert a measurement, teaspoon, tablespoon, cup, to a weight so that if I'm not sure about how much the volume should be, then I could know how much the weight should be that I should be looking for?
Yeah, it's a good question. I guess you're saying Texas onions are bigger than Rhode Island onions.
Cantaloupe size sometimes, yes.
Sometimes. Most of the time, we will list a volume measurement. Like a medium onion chopped is a 1 cup, for example. We will use weight measurements with flour because that actually makes a big difference in baking. In general, I believe in weight measurements. I know a lot of European cookbooks use a lot of weight measurements, which I think is a good way of doing it. Or we'll say 1 cup brown sugar, comma, lightly packed to give you some idea of how to measure it. But usually we'll give you a volume measurement if it's something like that. Or in the case of a tomato, most of the time it just doesn't matter. You know, there are cases where if you use a really large tomato versus a medium tomato, it may just not make that much difference if it's being thrown into a soup, for example. So we do try to list a specific volume requirement, not all the time, but when we think it's necessary. But weight would be the best way to do it, yes.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Mark on the line now in Fort Worth. Hi, Mark.
Hi there. Howdy, Chris. Glad to have you here.
Hey, how are you?
Very good, thanks. I'm in the same boat, wandering through our half-price bookstores. If I see anything with y'all's name on it, I'm grabbing it or getting it off the web. One question I did have, though, actually I've got a two-parter. Have you guys ever done a book on cast iron cooking?
We actually have one on the schedule for 2016. So
excellent.
It's one of my favorite. It's my favorite cookware, but we're going to do a book in a couple of years. Yep.
Same here in Texas. What I've been doing is cooking it out on the grill, using the grill like an oven, and cooking lasagnas and stuff out there instead of heating up the house when it's 110 out.
Hmm. I did a chocolate cake on a grill once, so there you go.
Oh, you're kidding me. All right. I'll look forward to the
book. No, there was a power outage, and I had no choice, but it worked out pretty well.
You had no choice. You had to have chocolate cake in that power outage.
Of course.
And then the other question I had was, comment and question, I enjoy the letters from Vermont that you do very much.
Thank you.
And I'm wondering, do you do a blog or anything on Vermont?
No. The letters are put on our website, thefeed.com. But no, I just write them for the magazine, or I write them for emails, and then they come and go, sort of old fashioned. You know, they don't exist as a group. But someday I may publish them as a book. Although somehow I think they work better on their own. But you can go, I think, to thefeed.com and pick up some of them there.
Back to the cast iron thing, there was actually an interesting feature on the website recently, and I can't remember which property it was attached to. If we find a cast iron piece that seems to be trashed, there's a pretty good chance we can bring it back to serviceable condition.
Yeah. Well, first of all, the first rule is be very careful about cleaning your cast iron, because you don't want to scrub it too hard. You never want to use soap. When I grew up in the summers in Vermont, they would leave the cast iron skillet on the stove at all times, with about a half an inch of grease in it. Hmm. So it was ready. We could do anything.
Ready
right
for
away.
Action.
Ready for action. If you have a really bad piece of cast iron with a really rough, rusted bottom, put a bunch of kosher salt in it, like about a cup, and some oil, and heat it up and rinse it. I mean, rub it hard with some paper towels and an oven mitt when it gets really hot. Do that 2 or 3 times and then oil it once it gets hot, and use that couple tablespoons of oil to finish off the interior.
Christopher Kimball is with us from America's Test Kitchen. He'll be in town for a live event Wednesday, October 29th at the Majestic Theater in Dallas. If you'd like to join our conversation, call us now at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering a new certificate program in project management November 3rd through 7th on the SMU campus. Information at smu.edu/project-management.
So I just want to bring this up to a simmer, and I'll cover it. We're going to cook this until the broccoli is really, really tender, and that's going to take about 20 minutes.
So, thanks to Ms. Waters, we have an entirely new way of cooking broccoli, which is essentially cook it to death.
That's right.
Right, to get great flavor. So, what's going on from a science point of view? Well, it turns out broccoli and all other members of the cabbage family have molecules called glucosinolates, and they contain sulfur atoms. That's perfectly fine because there are also enzymes in the broccoli, and they're locked away in the cell walls. When you heat things up, the cell walls break down, the enzymes attack the molecules, the sulfur atoms come out, you get sulfur compounds, and you get the traditional off sort of sour flavor. The great thing that Alice figured out on her own without our help at all is that over time those sulfur compounds break down and you're left with a sweet, nutty flavor. So for great broccoli, cook it a long time, the sulfur compounds break down, and you get a fabulous flavor.
That is my guest, Christopher Kimball, founder of Cooks Illustrated and Cooks Country magazines and host of what you just heard, an episode of America's Test Kitchen on PBS. There is an America's Test Kitchen event live this later next month, Wednesday, October 29th at the Majestic Theater in Dallas. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. You can also send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. You know, Chris, listening to that clip and watching the show, it occurred to me that this would have made a lot of science classes more interesting if we could attach actual sort of practical skills to them. Do you hear from teachers who use America's Test Kitchen in their classrooms?
Yeah, we do. And one of the things I'd love to do or eventually is to work on getting cooking back into the classroom and the science task, a way of doing it really is the way to get it back into schools, using cooking as a way of teaching science. And it just drives me crazy that, you know, home ec is gone. There are very few kitchens in schools. Kids don't get an opportunity to be exposed to cooking. But I think science would be the way into that. And over the next 5 years, I'd love to get involved with that.
Are you now, can you sort of work through the science on your own? Because I know your academic background was not in the sciences. Or what did it take for you to get to the point that this was content that you fully understood to the extent that you could use it in the show?
I'm laughing because the more I know, the less I know. I mean, Here's how it works. We have a science guy on call. He's in the office a lot. He's a real scientist. He gives you the information he thinks you can handle. You know, remember third grade with those stupid molecule things with the dowels and the colored balls?
Right,
you
right.
know? It turns out, I remember back in third grade asking, or fifth grade, whatever, asking my science teacher, I said, is this what it really looks like? And he said, no, it doesn't look like this at all. And I immediately lost interest in chemistry. And so I discovered that the first season of the show, I'd ask a question. He'd give me some pat answer about gluten. And then I'd know a little more. And I'd say, well, that doesn't really make sense because this. And then he'd say, well, yeah, you're right. I mean, I just tried to give you the simple answer. So I'm down to level 9 now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm headed to level 30 because the more you ask, the more complex it gets. And it's not simple science. Food, as I often say, Einstein never was a food scientist. It was just too hard. There are too many things going on at one time. It's hard to isolate specific effects. So, as I said, the more I know, kind of the less I know.
How do you decide? I would imagine that there are certain concepts that work really well for, say, audio presentation or for the print publications or work better in video. Are you sort of assigning different projects according to which medium will tell the story best?
Yeah, we have two print magazines. We do books. We have two television shows and now a weekly radio show the last couple of years, public radio. Radio, of all those things, was by far the hardest.
Hmm.
You obviously can't cook on the radio. I mean, we do one recipe a week very quickly. So you really have to rethink your entire presentation and how to talk about food. I mean, the obvious things are call-ins, of course, an interview I do every week. But your voice is different. You have to reinvent yourself for radio. You have to reinvent your relationship with the audience. It's very complicated. I think radio, to give you, credit, is the ultimate medium. It's very personal. You know, 5 seconds of dead air on radio is a lot of dead air.
Yes, it is.
You can get away with it on TV because you can watch those eggs being fried. And it's very personal. I mean, you really are having a talk, a discussion, a sit down with somebody. And you really, 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 there's a lot to know about that. So I would say print TV is not that hard, but radio is a totally different universe.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go back to the phones. We have Matt on the line now in Dallas. Hey, Matt.
Hey, Chris. I guess Chris is, right?
Chris is. Two Chris's.
Hey, how are you?
Great. I love both of your shows. I wanted to know, Chris Kimball, if you had any thoughts about, any more thoughts about crowdsourced recipes since your sugar cookie bake-off with Food 52.
Yeah. I have the same thought I had 2 years ago when we did the bake-off. There's nothing wrong with crowdsourced recipes in Food 52. It's just what they do. We have a very different point of view, which is that we want total control over a process and test all the different iterations. So literally, we'll test the recipe 40, 50, 60 times. It literally takes 6 weeks of someone's time to do it. And so that's our process for getting to a point where we're comfortable with a recipe. There's a million other ways to develop recipes. You know, some of my favorite recipes are from Yotam Ottolenghi, you know, who wrote Plenty in Jerusalem. He doesn't use a test kitchen. He and his partner do the recipes, and they're great. So it's just what we do, and it's the only thing we know how to do. So we're just going to stick to what we do well. But there's nothing wrong with crowdsourced at all.
Would people be surprised to learn how many cookbooks are full of beautiful pictures of recipes that nobody actually cooked and tasted?
Oh, I think everybody knows that 95% of all cookbook recipes are never made. But that's not, to be fair to cookbook authors, that's not really the only reason people publish cookbooks. So many people use cookbooks as inspiration. You know, they read them in bed before going to sleep. There's a lot of reasons to have a cookbook, just to get ideas. I think the problem is, to get back to the issue of whether recipes work, is at home, what actually happens in a home kitchen bears no resemblance to what happens in a restaurant kitchen or a test kitchen like we have. People tend not to read the recipes through carefully. They always substitute ingredients almost every time because they don't have exactly the right ingredients. They skip steps. You know, if a recipe says make dough day one and then sit in the refrigerator overnight for pizza, for example, they'll just make it and throw it on the grill 2 hours later. I've seen recipes where people substituted every ingredient, or a lamb recipe, they substituted beef. Or my favorite example is we did a chicken breast recipe a few years ago, and everyone loved it. We sent our recipes out to some of our readers and viewers to test, except one person who hated it, and he wrote back and said it was terrible. It's the worst chicken recipe I ever made. And then he said at the bottom of the questionnaire, you know, I didn't have any chicken, so I substituted shrimp, you know. And so you go, yeah, well, if you cook shrimp for half an hour, it's probably not going to turn out too well. So we live in the world of the real home cook's kitchen. The oven could be off 40 degrees, the wrong cookware, the wrong ingredients. That's really where the rubber hits the road in terms of cooking. It's not in a perfect world with all the time and the right ingredients can you make it. It's whether under real conditions. You know, so it's sort of like boot camp versus being on the front lines. It's just a different thing.
I love that you guys do equipment reviews, because it seems like we are constantly, you know, you walk into any home goods store and there is a new gadget that is going to change your life. Have you come to a sort of philosophy about how many items a well-stocked kitchen really needs, how many gadgets and tools?
Well, it changes. First of all, you're right. The most expensive stuff very often is not the best. There's a $40 Victorinox knife that tends to win almost all of our knife tastings, even against $150 knives. It's just better, has a better design. The more I cook, although I love gadgets, the more I rely on just a few really good pots, pans, knives. You know, Julia Child didn't have a kitchen full of every gadget. The more I know people who've cooked all their lives, the fewer gadgets and tools they use. But there are a few things. You know, a good standing mixer is essential. A good food processor is essential. A good skillet, a good saucepan, a good Thermapen instant read thermometer, a good timer. you know, there are a few things you really need, but a good knife, a good pan, and a standing mixer and a decent oven are helpful.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to Danny in Dallas. Hi, Danny.
Hi. I tried to do the soft-shell boiled egg, but one of the ladies there said she tried it 1,000 times.
Yep.
It didn't work.
I always wait for this call. There's always the, I tried your recipe, didn't work all. Well, let me just describe it for the listeners. We discovered that boiling eggs in water doesn't work very well because if you have 2 eggs versus 6 eggs, it can affect the cooking time. So we use 1/2 inch of water in a saucepan, bring it to a boil, put in as many eggs as you like, cover it, turn the heat down, and cook it exactly 6.5 minutes. And the reason that works is that steam contains a great deal more energy than water does because it requires a lot more energy to turn water into steam. So you can actually, all that stored energy will cook as many eggs as you like at a time. So I make this every weekend. Are you at altitude by any chance, or you're obviously not because you're from Texas?
Right, Dallas.
Okay, well you're not in Colorado. What happened and how did you do it?
Well, the thing is, I tried it exactly like the lady did, and it came out hard boiled. So I said this doesn't work. So I went back and I took the eggs in cold water and put enough water in there to cover the eggs up halfway. Then I put in a teaspoon of baking soda. I punched a hole in the big end of the egg. Brought it to a boil and put the eggs in, like you said, and I cooked it 5 minutes and 45 seconds. And it worked. I think it's because of the heat, the amount of water, and it worked. But my regular way of doing it is much more foolproof. And you can regulate it.
Can I ask you a question? If you, first of all, you didn't put the eggs in until the water boiled in our method, right?
Yes. Right.
And then secondly, once you hit 6.5 minutes, did you immediately run them under cold water?
Yes.
Okay, well, I think we need to send you a plane ticket. You can come to the kitchen and we'll use your method against ours. We literally did go through 2,000 eggs to do this. But you're using large eggs, by the way, not medium?
Medium.
He says he's
using
medium? Yeah.
Well, that would be the difference. Yeah, well, you have to use large eggs.
All right, so you've won this round, Chris Kimball.
Boy, that was close.
What happens? I mean, like, you can't have the staff eating 2,000 eggs. What happens to all the food that gets cooked and not eaten?
Well, we get asked this all the time. First of all, we have 150 employees, so all the food gets taken home. The really good food, which is the stuff we cook near the end of the testing, or the expensive lobster. That all goes to the test cooks because they grab it and put it in takeout containers with their name on it. In the middle of testing, when the food's pretty good but not great, marketing, we call the marketing department. And then the first few tests, which are always awful, is accounting. We find the accounting department is grateful for what they get. We're not licensed as a commercial kitchen. And what we'd like to do is give it to the food banks in the area. And we're not allowed to do that by law. At Cook's Country, however, when we're there filming, all of our excess food goes to the food banks and the pantries in Vermont.
It's ironic that your professional cooks probably never have to cook at home because they can bring things back from the office.
During the week, nobody who works, we have 50 test cooks, none of them cook during the week because they've been eating all day. You know, there's usually 60 or 70 different things being cooked during the course of a day. And some people have to eat 20 or 30 of those things. And so they're not doing much cooking during the week. They cook on the weekend. But Tuesday night after tasting 25 things, it's probably a salad. A salad and a glass of wine.
Are your test cooks all converted by the final result? Or are there people who say, yes, I get that the science worked on this, that it came out really well, but I prefer, say, soft boiling my eggs this way?
No, there's usually almost unanimous consensus because every time you test an iteration, you might test 3 or 4 versions and everyone writes down what they like. So very, very rarely would you get to the end of the process and everybody's not on board. The last step is to send that recipe out to a couple thousand people by email. A couple hundred of them will make it and send back a questionnaire. The key criteria is 80% of them have to say they'd make the recipe again. You know, that's the ultimate acid test for recipe. If we only get 70%, we go back to the boards, re-engineer the recipe, and send it out again. So it's not so much whether our test cooks like it. It's really our audience. And if the audience doesn't like it, then we don't publish it or we re-engineer the recipe.
Is there one particular dish that, like, is legendary around your offices for having for taking longer than you ever imagined that it would to fully perfect?
Oh, yes. The fudge, real fudge. About 5 years ago, we had a gentleman in the office who subsequently quit, actually, although he works for us on a freelance basis occasionally. He, great guy. He made, I think, 1,000 pounds or over 1,000 pounds of fudge over 2 months. He actually literally had shoulder separation problems from all that stirring. Mm. And I said, well, I'm going to take it home and try the recipe, but I'm not going to use my expensive instant read thermometer. And the problem is if you don't get the sugar syrup within 2 or 3 degrees, it's going to fail. And so it failed. And I said, well, you know, the odds of this working at home for thousands of people is very low. So we ended up with a microwave ersatz fudge recipe, which was foolproof, but not, you know, it didn't have that great crystalline texture. And we've never been able to make that work. I remember we looked at Martha Stewart Living, and she had a fudge recipe, and her head note said, if it doesn't work, just use it as a sauce over vanilla ice cream.
So, that's what she's hedging her bets.
Yeah, so that's one way of dealing with it. And so we decided that it wasn't just us, you know, that this is definitely a problem.
Well, that's why people only eat fudge on vacation.
That's why you buy it.
Yes.
Let somebody else make the fudge. Don't make it at home. Absolutely.
Christopher Kimball is with us. He is founder of Cooks Illustrated and Cooks Country magazines, host of America's Test Kitchen on PBS. On Wednesday, October 29th at the Majestic Theater in Dallas, there will be a live event for America's Test Kitchen. If you'd like to join the conversation now, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering a new certificate program in project management November 3rd through 7th on the SMU campus. Information at smu.edu/project management.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. America's Test Kitchen Live comes to North Texas Wednesday, October 29th at the Majestic Theater in Dallas. We're speaking this hour with its host, Christopher Kimball, who's also founder of Cooks Illustrated and Cooks Country magazines. If you would like to join the conversation, call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. By the way, Chris, Margaret sends this email. She says, I used the soft-boiled eggs recipe the day I watched it in Texas, and many times since, it works beautifully. So you are vindicated.
There we go. Thank you for that. I feel better.
Let's go back to the phones now. We have Andy on the line in Dallas. Hey, Andy.
Hello.
Hi. Go right ahead, please.
Okay. One quick comment. Your gluten-free apple crisp recipe was a humongous success. Just a little honey over the ice cream for a nice Rosh Hashanah treat. And my next question is, can you explain the difference between convection oven and a conventional oven and which of those recipes or what recipes might be applicable for which type of oven?
Sure. Convection oven usually has one or usually two small $10 fans in the back of the oven. It just means the air moves around in the oven. There's convection. What this does is to even out the oven temperatures. In any conventional oven, there might be 30, 40 degrees of difference between top, back, left, front, right, you know, part of the oven, bottom. The convection is particularly good for getting browning, for example, on bread. Would be good for chicken, roasting, that sort of thing. The best use is for cookies, so you don't have to switch racks and turn things around as much to get even baking. You'll get much more even baking. The one thing you never want to use it for are sweet desserts that rise, like a cake, for example. The top layer will dry out because of the air movement before it fully rises and sets. So you want to stay away from those kinds of recipes. But browning for roasts, cookies are good, breads, it's great use. Finally, in terms of cooking time, there's no rule. You can't just say reduce oven temperature or reduce oven time. It really depends on the recipe. There's no easy way to calculate that.
How do you decide to return to an old recipe that you've covered maybe years ago in the magazines or on the TV show because maybe people didn't see the original iteration?
Well, once in a great while, someone will say, like, there was a creme brulee recipe from 20 years ago, and we started getting mail that it didn't work the way it was supposed to. This was back in 95 or something. So we go back and test it. In fact, it didn't work the way it was supposed to. So we had to go back and fix that. That doesn't happen very often, but maybe half a dozen recipes over the last 20 years. Other recipes, we've learned something in the interim about how custard pies work. So went back and did pumpkin pie. Roast chicken, you can imagine we've done many times. There was one case about 2 years ago. We were roasting chicken, and the power went off in the kitchen halfway through. And it was the best roast chicken we ever had. So we said, turn the oven off halfway through baking, roasting. So we're better about science. You know, we'll understand salting better, or we'll understand how, you know, dried mushrooms, for example, add nucleotides and other things to enhance meat flavor. So, you know, we'll go back with new tricks in our bag and redo a recipe if we think we can do a better job.
Let me ask you this. We are always told by every cookbook I've ever picked up to buy the best olive oil we can afford. And I'm never quite sure how to determine that. But when you can't taste them in the store and you're taking a risk on something that might cost $15 for a little bottle or even more, are there things we can look for that might at least guide our stab-in-the-dark purchase?
Yeah, read Cook's Illustrated Magazine, and we'll do the tasting for you, besides that self-promotional point. First of all, most olive oil shipped over here from Europe is the worst grade because, A, it's not really monitored in the United States. In Europe, they can take bottles off the shelf, taste them, measure the acidic content, which is one of the ways you determine extra virgin, and pull the product from the shelves across the country if it's not meeting those standards. In this country, you can put garbage oil, hazelnut oil, you know, into a bottle and say extra virgin, and there's really no recourse. There's no testing going on. So that's why we end up with tankers full of really fourth-rate oil. I can tell you two brands, Columella, a Spanish oil, wins our tastings very often. California Olive Ranch also did well as a domestic oil. I use that a lot. The reason I like it is because it's fresh. I'm getting it soon after it was harvested. It's not been sitting around for a long time. One thing you should look at is you should look for the color doesn't matter, by the way. That's not going to tell you anything. Whether it has solids in the bottle or not probably isn't going to tell you anything. I look for a back of the throat almost burning. I'd like a very strong olive oil. And if you taste it raw, you put a little in your mouth, you inhale air through your mouth, mm-hmm. almost like tasting a white wine, for example, or red wine. And then the back of the throat, you should get some kind of a burn. And that tells you have a very strongly flavored olive oil.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Mark on the line now in Dallas. Hi, Mark.
Hi, how are you doing?
Very well, thank you.
Chris, I love your book on grilling, and I use it religiously. It's actually fallen apart because I use it so much. What is your favorite, or what are your favorite things maybe to do with smoking meat?
Well, if you're doing it on the grill, we use packets, soaked wood chips for 20 minutes in aluminum foil with a few slits cut in it on the coals. We just did, actually, burnt ends. We use a flat-cut brisket, cut it into 2-inch wide strips, and we started it on the grill with lots of smoke. We put lit coals down, put some packets of wood, covered that with unlit coals, gave it about 3 hours on the grill, then threw it in a pan, covered in the oven to finish for another couple hours. And they were not authentic burnt ends because burnt ends really are burnt ends of the brisket. But most burnt ends these days are the whole brisket. And that was one of my favorite. We also did a smoked barbecue bourbon chicken on the grill that was really smoky. Those are a couple of things I like.
Is there anything you don't care for that you have to cook with and test on a regular basis?
There are very few foods I don't like. I don't like foods that are so hot you can't taste all the other ingredients. Mm-hmm. So I'm not a big – I like some spice, but I don't want to be overpowered by spice. I don't like really heavy foods. I'm not a casserole person in general. You know, I like most of our casseroles, but that's probably not my first choice for food. In terms of – and I also don't like foods that are trendy. You know, I like all foods, but it, just because they're trendy doesn't mean I'm going to like them necessarily. I mean, like quinoa, for example, it has this weird light but crunchy texture. Mm-hmm. And we just came up with a new recipe for it, which I actually like. But, you know, trendy foods usually are not high on my list of things to eat just because they're trendy.
Let's go back to the phones now. We have Clark on the line in Weatherford. Hey, Clark.
Hello, Chris. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
And I'm just going to ask your guest his opinion on sea salt versus table salt, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for your call.
Well, salt is sodium chloride. It's 99% pure, so only about 1% of it is going to have minerals or anything else. I think the biggest issue about salt is it fine, like table salt, or it has big crystals? And that's what's going to give you a very different taste experience. So if you're dissolving the salt in a cookie, baked good, a soup, a stew, it doesn't really make any difference what you use. You know, pink Hawaiian salt doesn't matter. If you're going to sprinkle the salt on food just before serving, it makes a huge difference, or on bread just before serving. And the big crystals, Malden salt, for example, you get this wonderful crunch and this burst of salt. So if you want that kind of experience, sea salt or some other large crystal salt works great. Finally, kosher salts are larger crystals, and those will actually hang on to the food better. So if there's a case when you need to salt something like meat and you want the salt to really adhere to it, the kosher salt will do a better job. In fact, I don't use table salt. I just use kosher salt. It's easier to pick up in your hands, and I rarely measure salt. I tend to just have a salt box and use my finger, so it's easier to work with.
Are the measurements different when they go into a recipe and they say a teaspoon of salt? Do you use a little less table salt than you would kosher salt or vice versa?
Yeah, that's a good point. It depends on the brand. Diamond Crystal, other brands, usually a rough guide is about 50% more kosher salt than table salt. The reason is the crystals are bigger. So in a teaspoon, for example, there's a lot of air pockets between the crystals with a bigger crystal. So by weight, you should really measure by weight, and it's going to be at least 50% more kosher than table. It depends on the brand, though.
We have an email from Paul who says he is scrubbing pans in Terrell and wants to know if you have any scientific insight on nonstick cookware.
Yes. Buy a cheap pan. Most of these pans over the course of a year will end up being scratched, and some of the coating is going to wear off inevitably. So buying a $130 nonstick pan probably is not a great idea because you're going to have to throw it out after a year. So we use somewhat less expensive pans. Secondly, never heat them over 450 degrees. That's the point when you start getting a little bit of smoking. And if it gets over 550 degrees, the coating can actually break down. And if you inhale that smoke, you can get something called polymer fume fever, which I tested on myself once, just because I'm curious. Yeah, Department of Stupidity Department. Yeah.
So you tested it on yourself and things didn't go well, I'm guessing. Okay, I think we've lost our connection to Chris Kimball, who is, of course, the host of America's Test Kitchen, founder of Cook's Illustrated Magazine and Cook's Country Magazines. America's Test Kitchen and Chris Kimball, along with it, will be in town for a live event Wednesday, October 29th at the Majestic Theater in Dallas. You can find details about that appearance online. Chris, are you back with us? Oh, no. Okay. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number if you would like to join the conversation. And we'll take a call now and perhaps relay that question to Chris when we get him back on the air. We have Elizabeth on the line in Shady Shores. Hello, Elizabeth.
Yes, hi. I'm your fan. And I'm also a subscriber to Mr. Kimball's magazine. My question is, I would like him to explain the principle of cooking sous vide.
Sous vide. What does the term mean?
It's like cooking under a vacuum.
Cooking under a vacuum. Well, let's see if we can get an answer for you. Chris, are you with us? Okay, we do not have Chris Kimball with us, and if we get him back on the line, Elizabeth, we will certainly ask him about cooking sous vide, and hopefully we will fix this technical glitch in just a moment. If you are not getting all you want of America's Test Kitchen right now during the show, think about attending the live event taking place Wednesday, October 29th at the Majestic Theater in Dallas. Let's just take a quick break here and see if we can get Chris Kimball back on the line.
Police in Albuquerque say using deadly force is often just part of the job.
There's a lot of shootings that people are really upset about that were what we would call good shoots.
But does it have to be?
I could have shot him. I mean, I had every right to shoot him, but I didn't want to shoot him.
That story later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4, following Fresh Air on KERA 90.1.
Long-running legal battle, America's big oil versus Ecuador.
Donziger framed the only villain as Texaco and then Chevron alone, completely obscuring the role of the Ecuadorian National Oil Company and the Ecuadorian government.
Big oil, the Amazon rainforest, and the global economy, a tale told in court. Next time on Marketplace from APN.
Tonight at 6:30 on KERA 90.1.
On the next Fresh Air, how American politics went tabloid. The new book, All the Truth is Out, is about how the Gary Hart sex scandal in 1987, which ended his presidential candidacy, was a turning point in how the media cover politics, emphasizing character issues over political experience. We'll hear from the book's author, Matt Bai. Join us.
This afternoon, starting at 3 on KERA 90.1.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. Chris Kimball, I'm so sorry about the technical glitch we had, but I did want to make sure that we got a chance to say thank you so much for spending this hour with us. It's been really, really interesting.
I mean, great questions, too.
Thank you so much. Christopher Kimball is founder of Cooks Illustrated and Cooks Country Magazines, and he's host of America's Test Kitchen on PBS. He'll be in town for an America's Test Kitchen live event Wednesday, October 29th at the Majestic Theater in Dallas. Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.